journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just a second. Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass
descent. These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, September 28, 2011, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
A new study reveals the ever-increasing costs of health insurance. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and LA Times columnist Hector Tobar on his new book, The Barbarian Nurseries, and journalist David Barsamian on the politics of Kashmir.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. The annual Kaiser Family Foundation survey on health insurance premiums has found that employers paid 9% more for family coverage in 2011 than in the previous year. Last year, health insurance premiums went up only 3%. On average, family coverage costs $15,073 a year, an increase of almost double from 2001. Employers are not shouldering the growing burden alone. Kaiser's survey reveals employees are paying over $4,000 a year more for their $4,000 a year for their job-based insurance on top of out-of-pocket copays, deductibles, and other healthcare costs. The reasons for the spike are not clear-cut, but Kaiser attributed 1 to 2 percentage points of it to the 2010 Affordable Care Act. The Obama administration is on the defensive. White House Chief Deputy of Staff Nancy Ann DePearl took to the White House blog yesterday, summing up the administration's response as, quote, "The Kaiser report is informative, but it's a look backwards." The administration believes its Affordable Care Act will bring premiums down soon. DePearl argues insurance companies overestimated the costs associated with implementation of the Affordable Care Act, so premiums went up without an equal increase in cost. She cites the Bureau of Labor Statistics finding that for the first half of this year, the health insurance employer cost index was the lowest it had been in over 10 years. Also, for 13 of 14 major insurance companies, profits were 45% higher in the first quarter of 2011 than expected. However, the belief that healthcare reform is driving up costs remains strong. Katie Mahoney, Executive Director for Health Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, told NPR's All Things Considered yesterday that Obama's regulations are to blame for the increase.
There are a lot of benefit mandates and coverage requirements that were prescribed by the health reform law, but health insurance, like any product, is a product that right now we purchase in our country. And if you purchase a car that has leather seats and a sunroof, it's more expensive than an automatic with manual windows.
That's Katie Mahoney, Executive Director for Health Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, justifying the high cost of healthcare premiums. My guest is Dr. Rachel Narden, Chief of Neurology at Cambridge Health Alliance, Assistant Professor of Neurology at Harvard Medical School, and co-chair of the Massachusetts Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program. Welcome to Uprising, Dr. Rachel Narden.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, it's so interesting to see these health insurance companies raising costs ahead of the Affordable Care Act going into effect, but then turning around and blaming the Affordable Care Act for the increases, whether or not one is a supporter of the Affordable Care Act. Do you think that that's a justifiable reason?
Not really. I mean, I think, you know, that insurers, you know, they're a business and they're most for-profit insurers are beholden to their shareholders to raise profits. And, you know, they're worried about some attempts on the part of the Affordable Care Act to rein in their ability to make profits. So I think that they were attempting to raise premiums in advance of that.
They showed, the study showed that premiums increased 9%, but the Affordable Care Act, whose regulations on premium increases, instead of kicking in when the act was passed, kicks in next year. It will only ask health insurance companies to justify an increase of 10% or more in premium costs, which is even higher than the sharp increase. So insurance companies could easily raise premiums by 9.9% every year without justification. Is that right?
That's right. I think that's a very important point about the Affordable Care Act. Although it attempts to put some regulations on the behavior of private insurers, they're really relatively weak. The White House, in their response to the Kaiser Foundation report, also noted that they have some restrictions on insurance companies requiring the plans to cover 80% of medical costs, which is another thing insurers have been working hard to kind of figure out ways to get around. But if you think about it, that's terrible. You know, do we really want 20 cents of every healthcare dollar going to insurance bureaucracy, profit, and, you know, paperwork?
And
that
also
seems like a lot to me.
It seems as though the point of insurance is that when you need it, it should cover everything, not even 80%, but 100%. That's why you pay thousands, tens of thousands of dollars in some cases for insurance, right?
Absolutely. And I think that's a really important point about the Affordable Care Act. And, we're focusing a lot on the idea of just getting people an insurance plan, and we tend to look less at the quality of insurance that we're giving people. And another interesting thing about the Kaiser report is it talked about how cost sharing for patients is also increasing. So not only are we paying more in premiums, but when we have to see the doctor, our copays are going up. You know, when we need a medication, we pay more. And all those things actually reduce people's access to care.
Certainly. So people are less likely to go to the doctor because they know that a visit can cost upwards of $25, whether or not what they're worried about in terms of their personal health may turn out to be nothing. But why spend the extra $25 if money is tight?
Absolutely.
So I also understand that one of the reasons that these companies bumped up their prices, bumped up their premiums, was in anticipation of increased costs. Because, of course, they have to increase their prices the year before, set their increased prices for premiums the year before, and they project their costs. In this case, they projected their costs would go up, but apparently the costs didn't go up as much as they planned. So essentially, they charged patients more money than they could justify. Is that accurate?
That's right.
And so that extra money just goes into profits. It doesn't get credited back to patients.
Right. Which is one of the reasons why I don't like our current insurance system. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you have insurers that are motivated by all the wrong mechanisms. You know, what we'd really like is insurers to be competing to provide, you know, complete coverage for patients at the lowest possible cost. But what they're competing for is to take care of the healthiest patients so that they can retain the premium dollars as profit. So it's sort of a backward system that we've got in our country with the incentives all wrong.
So in terms of how the average family can cope in this economy with these ridiculous prices, it just seems very strange to think about a family paying $15,000 or requiring $15,000 of coverage, whether the employer of the parents in that family are paying for all of it or part of it. $15,000 to insure a family, it seems as though it's really unlikely that a family would end up requiring on any given year that much health care in costs unless there is a major catastrophe medically, which is, of course, why we always have insurance, because we worry that if we have an accident or some serious disease comes up, we may be left tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars in the lurch. Does insurance, private insurance in general, at least protect people from these very serious costs when there are major illnesses that kick in or accidents that happen?
Well, you know, first I'd like to just say that you're absolutely right about the $15,000 being ridiculous. I mean, it's several thousand dollars more than the annual income of someone who works at a minimum wage job. So, you know, the situation of healthcare costs in our country is absolutely unsustainable. And a lot of, you know, there are a lot of reasons for our high costs, much of which have to do with the kind of healthcare system that we've chosen. You know, we don't do things that a lot of other countries do, like looking at the evidence and deciding to pay only for things that really work. You know, we don't allow government programs to bargain with companies for good prices on drugs and medical devices. So a lot of things drive up costs that don't really have anything to do with improving the quality of care. And it's just completely unsustainable. And that really has to be changed.
My guest is Dr. Rachel Narden, Chief of Neurology at Cambridge Health Alliance, Assistant Professor of Neurology at Harvard Medical School, and co-chair of the Massachusetts Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program. One of the interesting, aspects of this study is also that it may help bolster the argument that hiring among companies is often discouraged because of the high cost of healthcare premiums. We're at a time in the economy when jobs are so scarce, but when a company is attempting to hire somebody, they have to figure in these incredible costs of healthcare as well. Do you think that health insurance premiums that are constantly increasing are affecting job creation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that these kinds of healthcare costs are bad for business. And, you know, I think I always wonder why business doesn't get behind, you know, something like a national health insurance program, you know, where instead of being subject to endlessly increasing premiums at the whim of private insurers, you know, they would pay a defined percentage of payroll tax toward a national health program, you know, would allow them to have consistent and predictable health care costs instead of the situation we have now where they're constantly, you know, juggling to meet these ever-rising health premiums. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of reasons for American business to get behind a single-payer system like they have in many European countries or in Canada, which gives much lower and fixed and predictable costs for health care to businesses.
And also we're hearing that health insurance premiums are set to rise by about 5% next year again. So even though the costs of health care that insurance companies had to pay out was not as high as they expected, which is what they'd used to justify the high rates this year, next year they're still going to be increasing rates by 5% on average. This is incredible. Is this also part of this mad dash to raise rates as much as possible before the Affordable Care Act kicks in, even though that act is so weak?
I think it is part of a mad dash, but it's also part of business as usual for private insurers. I mean, we have to remember that they are businesses, and they, you know, they are to a large extent interested in making sure that they have, you know, money for their administrative and profit aspects of their business. And, you know, I think a larger societal question is, do we really want for-profit businesses involved in providing health care, ensuring access to health care for, you know, all Americans? I think there's a collision of values there that doesn't lead to an optimal outcome. You know, I'd like a country where everybody had an insurance card, and when they were sick, they could go to the doctor and get care without having to pay amounts that they couldn't afford. And I think that the problem with the Affordable Care Act is that it won't really get us there. It's a very weak attempt to kind of bolster up our current, you know, dysfunctional system and rein in, you know, the worst excesses of the private insurers, but it's not going to fix any of the fundamental problems that we're struggling with.
And in many ways, the results of this survey confirm how weak the Affordable Care Act is. And just given the defensiveness of the Obama administration, does it seem as though the administration has painted itself into a corner by pushing and justifying and advocating for such a weak piece of regulation that it seems obvious even, you know, to ordinary people who might not know the nuts and bolts of the law that it's really not going to do much to protect them from future increases?
Right. Well, this is always a glass half full versus glass half empty problem, right? I mean, you know, you have to give the Affordable Care Act credit for, you know, some of the good provisions that mm-hmm. it has. But on the flip side, when you look at it as a tool for fixing the major problems in our healthcare system, it's not going to do it. So, you know, it really depends on, you know, which way you choose to look at it. But, you know, my belief as a single-payer supporter and as a physician in Massachusetts, where we just enacted a reform in the state level that's essentially identical to the national reform, and we've seen that it's just like it looks like the Affordable Care Act is going to be doing, it's done something, but it really hasn't fixed the major problems, and it's still left lots of people without insurance, lots of people at financial risk if they get sick. you know, you have to ask yourself, what's the big goal here? And if the big goal is really a system where everybody can get care without being going bankrupt when they're sick, then I don't think the Affordable Care Act, unfortunately, is going to get there.
Now, because of the insurance exchanges that will kick in when the Affordable Care Act goes into effect, will we see any kind of reductions in premium rates as the Obama administration is predicting?
Right. Well, I mean, we have the Massachusetts experience to draw on, and the exchanges were good at lowering prices for people that had to buy plans on the individual market, which is actually a very small number of people. But the exchanges have had an enormous difficulty controlling premium costs because the reform didn't actually have any cost control, right? And if, you know, although I've been kind of demonizing the insurers in our talk, they're, you know, and they may be overreacting and charging more than they need to, they're also struggling with rising health care costs that we can't control because we don't have a system in this country for controlling costs. So what happened in Massachusetts is you have this exchange trying to provide plans to people at affordable cost, but costs keep going up, and so their ability to actually provide affordable plans is limited. And what they've had to do in order to keep premiums down is increasingly shift more of the cost of care onto patients by increasing copays and deductibles. So you get in this situation where affordability becomes this notion where people are just passing the costs around. And so, you know, what we really need is a healthcare reform that addresses the fundamental overspending on healthcare in our country for things that don't provide good value.
Well, why are healthcare costs going up? I mean, certainly if there's no regulation, that's one thing, but where does that start? Does that start with private hospitals, with doctors? Where does it start?
Well, it starts with the fact that, you know, Americans are the first to adopt and use expensive technologies. And like we said before, we have no mechanism for requiring that things be proven to work before we pay for them. And we have no central organization that looks at the cost-benefit ratio of, say, very expensive cancer drugs and says, well, as a society, do we want to pay for a drug that extends life a month and costs, you know, $500,000? Or do we want to say that, no, we'd actually rather have everybody be able to be vaccinated or everybody be able to have primary care? We have no national discussion about those kind of priorities. We basically ration care on ability to pay. You know, if you can pay, you can get whatever, you know, treatment, regardless of how useless or marginally useful it is. And so in order to control those kind of costs, we need to start having a national discussion about our priorities, and we need to have some kind of system that allows us to pay for care according to those values.
And as a co-chair of the Massachusetts Chapter Physicians for National Health Program, I'm assuming you're a big advocate of a single-payer healthcare system.
You know, I just think that we've got all these other countries that do it better for less, and that, you know, although I know Americans we have a cultural, constitutional predisposition to doing things our own way, I think we'd do well to look at other countries that have actually solved this problem. There are lots of countries that provide care for everyone, you know, at less than half of what we pay. Mm-hmm. And they do it through single-payer systems that get rid of multiple insurers and all the waste, profit, and bureaucracy that goes along with them. And they do it by actually rationally using dollars for things that work and give value.
Well, Dr. Nardin, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Is there a website for Physicians for a National Health Program?
There is, www.pnhp, Physicians for National Health Program.org, and it has loads of information on all these issues that you've discussed.
And we'll link to that from uprisingradio.org. Thanks so much, Dr. Nardin.
It was lovely to talk to you. Take care.
Thanks. Dr. Rachel Nardin is the Chief of Neurology at Cambridge Health Alliance and Assistant Professor of Neurology at Harvard Medical School and Co-Chair of the Massachusetts Chapter of Physicians for National Health Program. That website is pnhp.org. This is Uprising. Later in the hour, we'll speak with journalist David Barsamian of Alternative Radio. He was in India recently and was deported over his journalism work on Kashmir. And after this short break, part one of a two-part interview with Hector Tovar, weekly columnist for the LA Times, on his newest book, The Barbarian Nursery. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly citizen investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow from bradblog.com. Join me for the Bradcast every Wednesday at 3:30 p.m. 30 minutes of troublemaking and muckraking ripped from the pages of bradblog.com and sometimes from the dark recesses of my mind. We'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers, we'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys if we can find any. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. We'll report on politics, elections, election reform, mainstream corporate media failure, media reform, global warming denialism, and everything before, during, and after. Join me for the Bradcast every Wednesday at 3:30 p.m. right here on Pacifica Radio's KPFK and coast to coast and around the globe on KPFK.org.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. With the race for the 2012 presidential election taking shape, immigration has once more become a high-profile issue. Tea Partiers and their ilk are accusing Texas governor and presidential candidate Rick Perry of being soft on immigrants, in particular for his support of the DREAM Act at the state level, which allows some undocumented students in Texas to pay in-state college tuition. But a growing tide of support for immigrant rights seems inevitable in an increasingly diverse nation, where Latinos in particular represent majority populations in dozens of American cities. More than 10 states now either allow or are considering allowing in-state tuition for undocumented students, including New York and California. It is in this cultural flux that Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, LA Times columnist and novelist Hector Tobar has published his book, The Barbarian Nurseries. Set in the wealthy suburbs of Orange County and the gritty barrios of Los Angeles, The Barbarian Nurseries is the story of a young undocumented Mexican maid, Araceli, and her liberal employers, Maureen and Scott Torres Thompson, and their three children. A marital dispute set off by the family's financial woes leads to an inadvertent abandonment by the Torres Thompsons of their two young sons, who are left in the care of the surly Araceli. In an attempt to find the children's grandfather, Araceli takes the boys on a journey via Southern California public transit across county lines into a drama politicized by the media and legal system. Ultimately, Araceli is accused of kidnapping the two American boys and becomes a symbol for conservatives to rally against and immigrant rights activists to rally behind, while her former employers choose between letting her take the blame and the possibility of losing their children to the state. The Barbarian Nurseries is Hector Tobar's third book following Translation Nation and the Tattooed Soldier. And today on part one of a two-part interview, he joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising, Hector Tobar.
Hello for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. So your book, The Barbarian Nurseries, features two characters, at least, of Mexican descent, two of the main characters, the main character being Araceli, this undocumented immigrant maid, and then Scott Torres, her American boss, who's half Mexican. Do these two characters represent the sort of polar examples of typical Mexicans in Southern California as well as the United States?
Well, I think that part of what the book is about is these many different layers of Mexican and Latin American identity in the city of Los Angeles. I think there are millions of people who live in Southern California of Latin American descent. Some of them have a grandfather or a great-grandfather who's from Durango or from El Salvador, and some are themselves people who've left from those places. And so I'm very proud of the book. For one of the things I'm very proud of the book for is that it has all these different layers of Latino identity. It can mean so many different things to be a Latino person in Los Angeles these days.
Your story spans both Orange County and Los Angeles, and I'm wondering why you set it in both places. Was it your intention to sort of contrast the two communities, that the suburbs versus the cities?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that the book is a tale of the social, the class and ethnic divisions in the metropolis. I started in Orange County because I began this book when I was an MFA student at UC Irvine. I was in the MFA program in creative writing. I lived in Orange County, and I would drive to Southern Orange County a lot.
And when was that?
Oh, that was in the late 1990s.
Wow.
Yeah, many years ago.
So it's a long labor of love.
Yes. I wrote an original version of this, which I cast aside for many years, and I went back and discarded most of it. And then when I reimagined the novel, I reimagined it as a journey across the metropolis from this pristine gated community overlooking the ocean to the barrios of central Los Angeles to South LA to Huntington Park, which to me is like the Brooklyn of Los Angeles. It's this working class, very proud community. And so, it was a definite conscious attempt to travel across Los Angeles in a work of literature.
And so in many ways, in reading the book, you get the sense that the setting, the location itself is its own character. And was that your intention, for this to be a story almost as much about the place of Southern California? And did you draw most of it from your own memory, your own background?
Oh, definitely. You know, I've been a reporter, a writer for various publications in Los Angeles, Southern California, for many years. I've written, this is now my third book that takes place at least in part in Southern California. I have spent a lifetime learning the vocabulary of Southern California, learning about the landscape. I took great pleasure, for example, I have a passage that describes the bird life in Huntington Park, because I spent a lot of time learning about the flora and fauna that we have, which is native and also transplanted. One of the characters has a rant about the parrots, the feral parrots that live among us. And for me, that's part of what it means to live in a place, is to know not just its people, but to know the surroundings. And for me, Los Angeles is just so many different kinds of worlds, natural and human. I've just had a great time describing those places.
And the parrots are seen as symbolic of the immigrant invaders by somebody who's anti-immigrant in your book.
Right. One of the anti-immigrant crusaders in the book. She is obsessed with the Mexicans that live on her block, and she's also obsessed with the feral parrots that are in the wash behind her home. For me, that was a way into that character, because to tell you the truth, I did also obsess about the feral parrots. I felt that they didn't belong here. You know, you see these birds in the San Gabriel Valley in South Pasadena, and you know that they don't belong, and they're actually escapees from Brazil. They come from the tropics to live among us. And so for me, that was a way to get close to that anger that I know a lot of people feel towards immigrant Los Angeles as this alien outside presence that to them doesn't belong.
Well, let's talk about the main character, Araceli Ramirez, who is very multidimensional. She's not just an undocumented maid. She's surly.
Yes.
She has a background as an art student. Who did you base her on?
Well, she's really my alter ego. you know, I am an intellectual trapped in the, brown skin body of a Guatemalan. You know, for many people, Guatemalteco, Guatemalan is synonymous with servant, with housekeeper, with domestic. And, this book is really about my sort of lifelong struggle to be an intellectual. You know, I mean, that's why I wrote the book. Araceli is someone who's a lot like a lot of people that I know. I mean, she has intellectual aspirations. She hasn't had the means to fulfill them. In the book, she is a student in Mexico City. I lived in Mexico City for many years, so I drew on those experiences. She's an art student. She's come to this country seeking, you know, opportunity. And instead, she finds a job which is very tedious, which is very confining. She lives up in this gated community. And yet she hasn't lost her dreams. She's also based on some of the women who worked in homes that I lived in when I was a foreign correspondent in Latin America. Mm-hmm. I was a foreign correspondent for The Times in Mexico City and Buenos Aires. And one of the wonderful things about being an expatriate for an American corporation is that you get sort of the luxurious treatment. When you live abroad, you live well. And so we had women who worked in our home that we got to know of many, many different kinds of personalities. And we did have one or two women who worked for us who were just obviously not very happy to be working for us. And so some of the nicknames and some of the surly behavior is behavior that I witnessed in my home.
She's very defiant too. But at the same time, one of the things that came through to me was that she seemed to find solace in the sort of order and pristine atmosphere in the United States, almost as an escape from the chaos of Mexico City.
Right. I think that is something that I that I gave her because it's something that I feel when I'm in a North American home. I'm an American-raised man. I have this vision, this suburbanite vision of what elegant is, a progressive vision of the way I should raise my children. Maureen, the woman that Araceli works for, is a very progressive-minded person. She's well off, but she wants her children to read. She wants her boys not to be violent. The home that Araceli works in is much like my home. And it's a home that I think is just a vision of what North American people think that their home should look like. It's a place where you nurture children and you spend a lot of money so that you nurture your children well.
Hmm. And the peace of that home is broken in the book in a very dramatic way that I want to get to. But I want to ask you about the title of your book. There's a garden in the Torres household that seems to play a significant role. It's transformed from being this impractical, high-maintenance rainforest to a drought-tolerant, succulent garden. And I'm guessing by the title of your book, The Barbarian Nurseries, that perhaps it's symbolic of something?
Yeah, the title, The Barbarian Nurseries, is a play on themes and images that appear many times in the book. First off, yes, there is this wonderful succulent garden, this subtropical garden that the Torres Thompsons have that's also very impractical. And it's dying because they can no longer afford the Mexican gardener who came to keep it alive. So they decide to get rid of it and put in a desert garden. And so these gardeners arrive, two sets of gardeners arrive, and the first set of gardeners is charged with destroying the subtropical garden. And they arrive with machetes, and they destroy the garden. And to me, that's the first barbarian nursery, because it's these gardeners who come from what a lot of American people think is an uncivilized place. There's this image of Mexico. Especially now, today, as a place of barbarism, a place without civilization, of violence. And so they are the barbarian gardeners because they come from this country that a lot of Americans associate with lack of civilization. Now, later in the book, when Araceli becomes a figure of media hate, when she becomes a subject of hatred on talk radio, there's a right-wing commentator on television who makes a comment about the women who raise our children. He says, I don't understand how we American people, American families, can allow these women from this uncivilized country, this underdeveloped country, to raise our kids. It's the most important thing we have to do. How is it that we allow these women from this backward place to raise our children? And that is the other barbarian nursery, the place where we raise our children, where the women who are in charge of it are from this underdeveloped place, the barbarian creche, if you will. And so that's that notion of nursery as a place where you grow plants and where you raise children is what the title refers to.
My guest is Hector Tovar. He is a weekly columnist for the LA Times and author of The Barbarian Nurseries. It's his latest book. And I'm wondering, Hector, if you can read a section of your book for our listeners.
Oh, it'd be my great pleasure. It seemed impossible to Araceli that a family and a home could become something akin to an island surrounded by vast stretches of salt water, and that its young inhabitants and their innocent housekeeper might become castaways. The peninsulas that linked this island to a continent of annoying relatives and nosy neighbors had been quickly and definitively washed away. Araceli realized now that the daily solitude she felt in this home, the oppression of the droning appliances and the peopleless views from the picture window, was not hers alone. This American family, whose home she inhabited, had come to this hill above the ocean to live apart from the world. They are runaways, like me. It was an obvious truth, but one Araceli had never fully pondered before. Among Mexicans, the peculiar coldness of the Norteamericanos was legendary because it came to infect the many paisanos who lived among them. One heard how individualism and the cult of work swallowed up the hours of the American day, their sunsets and their springtimes, causing their family gatherings, their friendships, and their old people to disappear. But it was quite another thing to be thrust directly into an American family's lonely drama, to find your Mexicana self a player in their game of secrets and silences, their separation from one another by long stretches of freeway, by time zones and airline hubs, and long-distance phone rates.
Hector Tovar reading from his book, The Barbarian Nursery. So this is the time when the maid Araceli finds herself alone in the house with the two boys of her employers. Her employers having both run off after a fight, thinking the other was at home, in effect leaving the boys in her care. She doesn't very much even like to take care of children, but she finds herself in charge. I want to ask you about this position that Araceli finds herself in and how you track her path, her decision-making, if you will, into the streets of Los Angeles from the safety of this home into the wide and frightening world of Los Angeles.
Yes, she really doesn't like taking care of children. In fact, they give her nicknames like Madam Weirdness and Sergeant Araceli because she's so mean. But she's left alone with these two kids for a couple of days. Time passes, and the kids are very nervous. She has to sort of sleep next to them. The kids are hungry. And so she looks for the one place, where can I take these kids? As I read in that passage, they have no relatives that call on the phone all the time.
Sort of a symbol of American suburbanism.
Right, and of American individualism. And, you know, this is a very – having lived in other countries, there's a lot of solitude in the United States. There's a lot of loneliness. And so she feels that. And she looks on the mantelpiece and she sees a picture of the boy's Mexican grandfather, El Abuelo Torres, I call him in the novel. And he lives she sees this picture and it was taken circa 1950. And it was obviously taken in front of a bungalow. And she takes the picture out of the frame and she sees an address on the back. And she realizes that that's where the grandfather lives. And so in Mexico City, people don't move. You know, they don't move like we do. They don't change houses like we change clothes. So she feels that there must be a relative there. And so she takes the boys to this address on the train and they go to Union Station and they have this journey from suburban Southern California to the heart of very old, almost 19th century feel to the center of Los Angeles. Hmm.
She is thrust into this undocumented immigrant maid is with the two white children of this Torres Thompson's American children, one quarter Mexican,
right.
Into a drama then that unfolds primarily because of a sort of sensationalist media that takes the story and parses it into its most reductionist forms. And as somebody who is a member of the media, I want to ask you how you came to depict our mainstream media today in this way, because even that seems so barbaric, to quote your book, you know, transform this story of what could have resolved itself in a simple way into something really dramatic and becoming symbolic of the fight over immigration.
Right. I think that I used to be a young police reporter at the Los Angeles Times, and a lot of the descriptions there of the media scrums at the different homes and the courtrooms are things that I lived. We're chasing melodrama. We're chasing human drama that's boiled down to its very essence of evil and good. And we're looking for people to play those roles. And there's a whole machinery that exists to create that. And it exists by looking at people in a way opposite to what a novelist does, which is to look at people and as arguments instead of as their full complex humanity. And so I think I had great fun describing this machinery circling these characters who I have had attempted to describe in their full humanity, and a situation that's very – a family situation like many family situations is complex, and yet it's reduced to good and evil. To even Maureen and Scott, who are the parents of the two boys, are wrapped up in this because they are judged as parents. They're the ones who left these two boys with their Mexican nanny. And so they inadvertently sort of fuel this citywide criticism against Araceli because it's a way of deflecting attention away from themselves. They're afraid of losing their two boys to, you know, the Department of Children's Services, which looms above them.
So Araceli is painted as a kidnapper.
Yes, Araceli is painted as a kidnapper. It happens by a series of accidents. In fact, one of the ironies is that the police officer – who sets this off is himself a Mexican-American who arrives at the home. I describe him and he sees Araceli's art on the walls inside of the room where she lives, and he doesn't understand art. And I describe him as the very small percentage of Mexican-American people in Southern California who've never heard of Frida Kahlo. And so she has a Frida Kahlo that's a very graphic, you know, pasted to her wall, and he sees this and thinks that it's sick. It's a sick painting. And then there's Araceli's own sort of self-portraits and everything, and he finds it. He thinks it's the artifacts of a disturbed mind. Mm. And so he is the first one to think this is, might be a kidnapping, because even though he's Mexican-American, he's been reading all these stories about Mexico, and he thinks that maybe she took the boys into some crazy, you know, drug-fueled kidnapping ring. He lets his imagination run away with him, and he's the one who begins to set off this media firestorm.
Hector Tobar is my guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, LA Times Weekly columnist, and we're discussing his book, The Barbarian Nurseries. Tomorrow, we'll play part two of my interview. He's going to be at the annual West Hollywood Book Fair this Sunday, October 2nd at 2:45 p.m. You can find out more at westhollywoodbookfair.org. Next Tuesday at 7 p.m. at Skylight Books, that's October 4th. And then next Wednesday, October 5th at 7 p.m., he'll be at Romans Books in Pasadena. Check up RisingRadio.org later today for a list. You can also visit Hector Tobar's own website at HectorTobar.com. Also on our website later today, you can watch a video of my entire interview with him. After this short break, David Barsamian on his recent deportation from India and the situation in Kashmir. Stay tuned.
I would love to know why didn't they let you go? When did you leave heaven?
When Did You Leave Heaven by the Cold Downing Band based in Los Angeles. You can find out more at reverbnation.com/the Cold Downing Band or check the featured music section of uprisingradio.org later today. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. David Barsamian, activist, writer, and founder of the national radio show Alternative Radio, was deported from New Delhi, India on Monday. Barsamian was on his way to Srinagar, the capital of Jammu Kashmir, for a three-week-long investigation into reports of mass graves found in the area. His trip was prompted by the Indian State Human Rights Commission's release of a three-year-long inquiry and report, which found that over 2,000 bodies buried in 38 different unmarked graves in Kashmir. While the Indian government stated that Barsamian was deported because he had apparently violated his visa stipulations on his previous trip to India, others in the human rights community suspected that the real reason was to avert attention from the ongoing allegations of abuse and torture by Indian security forces in response to a rebellion in Kashmir that began in 1989 and continues today. While people living in the region have complained about systemic abuse, torture, and detentions at the hands of the Indian security forces who were sent in to quell the uprising, the Indian government is only now officially acknowledging the situation with the issuing of the Human Rights Commission report. Kashmir, which is the only state in India to have a Muslim majority, was separated into Pakistani and Indian administered territories after the partition of India in 1947. Using the Public Safety Act, which was passed back in 1978, the Indian government started detaining people in Kashmir for 1 to 2 years without trial using questionable reasoning. Amnesty International estimates that Indian forces have detained between 8 to 20,000 people using circumstantial evidence. And a 2010 WikiLeaks cable found that the International Committee of the Red Cross met with the U.S. Embassy in Delhi to discuss torture and unfounded detentions by Indian security forces. It is estimated that up to 70,000 people have been killed over the duration of the rebellion. India has sent over 500,000 troops to the area, more than double the troops sent over by the U.S. during the height of the Iraq occupation. Barsamian stated, quote, "The human rights violations in Kashmir are extensive and have totally gone underneath the international media's radar. If India claims to be the world's largest democracy, maybe it should be looking at what it's doing in Kashmir." David Barsamian now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising.
Good morning, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Now, you're not the first person to be deported from India over, apparently, your work on Kashmir. Is that right?
Yes. In November of 2010, the academic who's based in the San Francisco Bay Area, Richard Shapiro, was deported in similar circumstances. And one of the reasons I'm very worried about my own deportation case that Shapiro, now almost a year later, has not been allowed back into India. And he, too, as I, have received no explanation from the government of India. It's a very Kafkaesque-like situation. We don't know what we're being accused of, and therefore we cannot respond.
So how significant is the report by the Human Rights Commission on these unmarked graves? And is that essentially what you were going to investigate?
That was part of it. I also had an interview scheduled with Dr. Binayak Sen on Gandhiji's birthday, October 2nd. Binayak Sen, for those of you listeners who are not familiar with, is a well-known human rights activist. He's a medical doctor who went to Chhattisgarh, one of the poorest states in India, and provided medical services to the largely Adivasi population, the indigenous population in Chhattisgarh. He was accused by the chief minister of Chhattisgarh, Raman Singh, of sedition, of collaborating with Maoists, Naxalites, terrorists. These terms are used very promiscuously in the Indian media and also in Indian government jargon. And he was sentenced to life in prison. He's out on bail right now only because a number of Nobel Prize laureates, very well-known, recognized international figures, petitioned the Indian government that he be released on bail, and that the case should be re-examined. So I was going to also interview Binayak Sen. Now, the recent report that you referred to just confirms another report that came out in 2009, in November of 2009, called Buried Evidence, Unknown, Unmarked, and Mass Graves in Indian-Administered Kashmir. Now, this report was dismissed by the Indian government and totally ignored by the international media. It was written by distinguished academics and activists, including Khurram Pervez, Angana Chatterjee, Pervez Imroz, Gautam Nolaka, and others. The report that you refer to simply confirms the details and the documentation in the original November 2009 report. So they can't say that, well, these are, you know, Marxist sympathizers or something like that. This was, in fact, an official body that has now delineated the fact and documented the fact that several thousand people are buried in graves all over Kashmir. You mentioned, by the way, that 500,000 Indian Army is in Kashmir. It is the most densely militarized zone on the face of the earth. The actual figure is closer to 700,000 when you include the local police, the border patrol, and other militia-like forces, government military forces, so it's closer to 700,000. Now, the bodies in these graves have been found to have been shot at very close range in execution-like fashion and have exhibited signs of torture. So this is a huge embarrassment to New Delhi, which constantly proclaims it's the world's largest democracy, and that the rebellion in Kashmir, which began in 1989, is the work of miscreants, that the Kashmiris are simply pawns in the hands of the Pakistanis. They're being manipulated, and the government does not give any credence to Kashmiri demands for justice, for human rights, and also for independence. And that's why this is such a critical issue for the Indian government. While there are uprisings all over India, in Chhattisgarh that I mentioned, Jharkhand, Orissa, the one in Kashmir and the one in the northeast of the country are significantly different in that they are not trying to change the regime in New Delhi and replace it with another form of government. They want out of India.
And David, the recent very, very widely reported movement against corruption in India has gotten so much more attention than, for example, the rebellion in Kashmir. But you describe, you compare the rebellion in Kashmir to Egypt's uprising. Can you tell us a little bit more about the nature of what's happening in Kashmir and why it's not getting as much media attention?
Something very fundamental happened in the Kashmiri uprising. In 2008. It was a process over the years of moving from militant, violent resistance to nonviolent civil disobedience. And huge crowds came out at the Eidgah, right outside of Srinagar, and also at a number of times at Lal Chowk, which is Red Square in the heart of Srinagar. Up to 1 million Kashmiris turned out to peacefully demonstrate for their rights. This is in 2008. This is in 2009. This is in 2010. This is before anyone ever heard of Tahrir Square in Cairo. And while that was being celebrated as, you know, something wonderful, and it was, the demonstrations in Kashmir were completely ignored. And I think is very significant. The level of repression has been ratcheted up tremendously. There's a huge amount of surveillance going on. I've never been in a situation as I found myself in Kashmir last February when I spent some time there. Every phone call is monitored. Every email is read. People are being tailed. There's a huge amount of intimidation. You probably know about the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, mm-hmm. which allows for indefinite detention without any evidence being presented. Thousands of Kashmiris have been arrested or are in jail. And again, in this Kafka-like situation, they don't know what they're being accused of. And so the human rights abuses continue, and I must say, are accelerating. And now New Delhi wants to control all the information, as all powerful states do. They want to present, a certain veneer, a facade about what it is doing in Kashmir, that it's fighting terrorism, that the people there have been misled by, foreign agents and the like. And they give no credence to very legitimate Kashmiri demands for self-determination. So while the world and Washington celebrate Arab peoples rising up in Tunisia and Egypt and elsewhere, when Kashmiris do it, it doesn't count.
My guest is David Barsamian, founder and director of the award-winning program Alternative Radio. He's a journalist, author, and lecturer, and has recently been covering the political situation in Kashmir and other political issues in India. He was recently deported from India upon arriving there, ostensibly over his work on Kashmir. Now, let's also talk about the context of what we're discussing here, which is the U.S. Relationship with India. How much role does the U.S. relationship with India play in India's policy on Kashmir?
Well, Washington has given India carte blanche to do what it wants, not only in Kashmir, but in the Northeast as well, in the Assam, Meghalaya, Nagaland, Manipur area. Washington and New Delhi have been moving increasingly closer in terms of political military alliance. Obama went to India last November, fulfilling his actual role as president of corporate America, when he had an entourage of 200 CEOs with him, and he was selling weapons to India. So there's been very close military ties. There's been joint military training exercises. Israel also is involved heavily in India with selling of weaponry as well as training. And so Washington and New Delhi, it's rather ironic because here was India under Nehru and later the leader of the non-aligned movement. And now, as Arundhati Roy ironically says, India has become part of the very aligned movement. And Washington sees the Kashmir issue as an internal matter for the Indian government. and will not comment on it.
Also, just briefly, with the U.S. being more openly critical of India's main rival, Pakistan, in recent days over the U.S. embassy bombing in Kabul, I'm wondering what you think of the game that the U.S. is playing and has been playing for so long between India and Pakistan, vis-a-vis even Afghanistan and the war that it's waging there.
Pakistan is in an extremely parlous and fragile situation. Who knows, after the next big bomb attack, if the state just doesn't disintegrate even further. And U.S. actions in Pakistan, first having manipulated the country for decades as part of its various military alliances, the Baghdad Pact, and CETO, and using Pakistan as a bridge to create the Mujahideen, which later morphed into the Taliban in the 1980s during the struggle to oust the Soviet Union from Afghanistan. Washington has very, very heavy fingerprints in Pakistan, and I'm very concerned if you're following these reports, the comments from Mike Mullen, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, other comments that have been coming from Brennan and high Washington officials. It looks like they're planning for some kind of military action against Pakistan, which will just further destabilize that very, very weak country. India and Pakistan have serious internal problems. People need food, people need housing, people need health care, people need education, and not the weaponry that Obama is selling when he goes to New Delhi, or the weaponry, offered to Pakistan as well.
Well, David Barsamian, on that note, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks very much. And for more information, people can go to my website, alternativeradio.org.
And we'll also link to that from our website later today at uprisingradio.org. You can find out more about Alternative Radio at alternativeradio.org. David Barsamian is founder and director of the award-winning program Alternative Radio. He's a journalist, author, and lecturer. He has written a number of interview books with people like Iqbal Ahmed, Arundhati Roy, Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, and others. He's been recently covering the political situation in India and particular Kashmir, as well as the case of Dr. Binayak Sen. Again, alternativeradio.org is the website. For Sonali, subversive thought for the day, Theodore Roosevelt once said, "Justice consists not in being neutral between right and wrong, but in finding out the right and upholding it wherever found against the wrong." And that's Theodore Roosevelt. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Bipasha Shom is our intern. Chris Bennett is our music curator. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can order a copy of today's show at 1-800-735-0230 or at pacificaradioarchives.org. Join us at facebook.com/uprisingradio, follow us at twitter.com/uprisingradio, and email us at mail@uprisingradio.org. You can listen to the show online, find links, local events, and other information we mention on the air at uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.